Okay, so today we're going to pick up in Nahum, and we're going to look at chapter 2. I don't know whether any of you read this or not. It's not long, it's only 13 verses, but there's a number of things going on in chapter 2 that I want to point out to you. Chapter 2 is certainly a continuation of chapter 1, but one of the things you notice if you read it is the intensity and the tone and the voice. Now goes from passive to active. So you see a real active voice in chapter 2. And part of that is that Nahum is pronouncing the judgment that's going to happen to Nineveh. And with that, he's excited. I'm sure he's energetic. He's pronouncing this judgment in a very visible and a very animated way. And when I kind of walk through what he's talking about, and break it down a little bit better for you to see the context of it, you'll understand a little better what he's trying to do. So in chapter 1, we looked at things like Nineveh was going to be judged and all that. In chapter 2, we're going to look at the details of it. And then in chapter 3, we will finish it with kind of the aftermath of all of that and some other things that the prophet wants to say to both Judah and the people of Nineveh. So we'll do that next week and we'll finish that session. So here's kind of what our plan is. Today we're going to do Nahum chapter 2. Next week we'll finish it. And then after that, I'll pick a new lesson to start in the New Testament. So we'll get kind of back out of the Old Testament, back into the New Testament. And I've got two or three ideas to do in there. I do a lot of books and I'll do, ones that we haven't done before, perhaps. So if you have ideas, let me know. I got a couple of my own, so we'll see how that turns out. So let me do a quick update on the Middle East. Not a lot has happened that is published right now, but what's happening is a lot of continuation. Hezbollah is continuing to attack Israel in the north, and there's about 100,000 people, maybe 200,000, that live in North Israel. That have had to leave their homes. So, when you take a look at that and you say, well, how does that compare? You think 200,000, well, that's not that bad. But out of 8 million, that's a big percentage. If you said that same percentage out of 340 million in the US, it'd be millions of people. So, you kind of understand the scale of what's happening over there. And Iran is still pushing their proxies. They're attacking the U.S. bases in Syria and in Iraq, and I'm sure over time the U.S. is going to get fed up with that and will strike back. I don't know what they're going to do. Iran is playing a middle of the road game right now. They're trying to be like a cat, smacking but not hitting too hard because they don't want to get smacked back. And I think that's kind of the game they're playing. But sooner or later, you get tired of it. And I think Israel is getting tired of it. The US will get tired of it as well. So I've got here 1 million Israelis. I think that's the accurate number. I said 200,000. So 1 million have had to leave their homes, and that's about 40 million by comparison to the US. So you think about 40 million people having to leave their home because of terror activity. You see the scale of what's happening over there. It's not published. We don't see a lot of data on it. Nobody's protesting at the college campuses because of that. They got other things on their mind, but it is pretty decisive. The other thing I'll tell you is Israel is getting ready to go into Rafah, and what they've done is they've begun moving tanks. And if you're a student of earth moving equipment, they moved their big D9 Caterpillars, which is the giant caterpillar with the big scoop on the front end. They're moving those in. Of course, they're all painted camouflage and have armor plating on them, but they're going to just, my guess is they're going to go in with tanks and they're going to bulldoze and they're just going to go after these tunnels and bulldoze them out. And they're preparing for that. What you see now is Gaza is trying to hold them off by giving proof of life videos of a couple of people that are there, they've got hostage. So but they're supposed to have 130 that are alive. They claim 40. So I guess we don't know and won't know until this gets a little better. America has its portable dock. If you've been watching this, America's got a portable dock that's going to be docked in Gaza to deliver relief supplies. It's a little too late to, because 450 trucks a day go in there with relief. So I'm not sure what this is going to do, but they've already fired missiles at the U.S. dock going in. So I don't know. I think it's one of those things where it makes us look like we're doing something, even though it's not very effective. But anyway, that's going to be probably in early May that will dock and be a source of relief supplies. They'll be able to come in by Navy and then transport in. Bill.
I just expressed my opinion when I say this, but I'm looking forward to November.
Yeah, it's the month before Christmas. I understand why you're
looking. The United States needs to take a stand with this.
No. Oh, I know. We invite weakness when we're weak, and we invite aggression against us and all of our countries that we support. And we're seeing that today. So, yes, I share your sentiment. In the U.S., I think the college campuses are we're seeing a lot of that. What you may not notice is that this is being funded by George Soros. And when you go to one of these campuses and they've got all new REI tents that they're living at, that are all bought at the same time and set up, you know, somebody's spending big money. And yet they interview a couple of these protesters and they don't even know why they're there. They're just paid to show up and they do. And, you know, it's done to intimidate and make us think that the whole world is against Israel. And in reality, it's not. And we just got to not be fooled by that. And of course, as Bill pointed out, election season, chaos is everywhere. You know, the border crisis is going on. The good news is Congress has funded enough money for Israel to get back equipment they shot off against Iran. So they're going to get a new supply of weapons. But on a side note, the U.S. has been a player in Africa for dozens of years, and they're being driven out by some of the African countries who are beginning to side with Russia. And as you know, if you read the news, Christians are being slaughtered by the hundreds over there. In, I guess it's Nigeria and a couple of other places. It's just what used to be a fairly safe place for people to go and witness is not any longer. Boko Haram and some of these other militant groups don't just capture them, they go in and butcher them. And so that's a problem, and it's not going to get any better. And that's kind of an update that I have. It's I think Israel is on a wait and see method. I think right after Passover, which is now over, I expect Israel to move into that final part of the Rafah, the final part of the area of Gaza. And hopefully that will bring an end to Hamas. They'll capture them and they'll get hopefully as many of their people back alive as they can. That's always a risk, but I don't think leaving them there and trying to negotiate with them is going to be an answer, because they don't want to negotiate. They want Israel to surrender and walk away, and that's not going to happen. So it's coming. I don't know exactly when or exactly how, but I think we're certainly closer than we've ever been now to seeing Rafah come to pass. Yeah.
It was the Arabs that went into Israel and slaughtered people.
Oh, yeah.
And hit her on our campuses and upsetting, you know, education process for a lot of non-participants in particular.
Well, and a lot of the protesters are not even students. You know, they're hired protesters that they send in. And, you know, they're agitators. It's just part of what they do. And until we get tough with them, you know, I see where Texas arrested a couple of hundred on the Austin campus, very liberal campus, by the way, but the Texas Rangers and a couple of the others are not putting up with some of that stuff.
And it's not a liberal governor, I can tell
you. No, it's not a liberal governor. And so what we're seeing is the red states, I hate to be that way, but the red states are fighting this very successfully. The blue states are kind of letting it go, thinking it's going to burn its way out. Much like the, you know, stuff that raged a couple of years ago, Black Lives Matter and all that, you know, burn cities down, kill people, and just, you know, give them a pass. So we're seeing that, and If I would say that the interesting news to me is that really sharpens the focus for what happens in November, because we're beginning to see a lot of people who didn't take sides now are beginning to take sides, and many of them are coming to what you might call the common sense side. And so I hope that's the case. I guess we won't know until it's all over, but certainly what my hope is. So back to Nahum. Nahum, we saw an opening in purpose. We saw in the first chapter that God was going to judge Nineveh, and he was going to not only show his kindness to his own people, but he was going to talk about Nineveh's overthrow and the joy that would come to Judah later. So we did that. And in chapter two, we get to see more details of the judgment, as I mentioned before. We get to see the details of the besieging of Nineveh, and then how it's really going to be desolated and destroyed. And you can see that in the words that the prophet uses. And then, of course, next week we'll talk about the sin that provoked this and kind of God's last word on Nineveh. If you don't know, the city of Nineveh was lost to history until about 1846. I think I have a note in here when somebody was over in around Mosul, Iraq, and discovered the city of Nineveh is a big mound, you know, a heap of ruins. And so God's promise to destroy them came true. And I do have a chart that I've put together. I'll show it to you today, but I'm not going to put it on the screen because it's too busy and I've got to go clean it up a little bit. But I do have it, so I'll have it in the pack of slides that are here. And if you want me to send it out, I will. It's the chart that shows the judgments promised and the judgments fulfilled, you know, verses, and then secular history that proves that. It's kind of interesting because you look at this and you think, well, that's interesting, but we don't know much about it. Actually, we do, because there's a lot of history that was written from the Assyrians' point of view and the Babylonians. There's a lot of secular history that backs up what happened to Nineveh, and we'll talk about that. So Nahum chapter 1 ended in verse 15 in our Bible, which is really chapter 2, verse 1 in the Hebrew Bible. So I'm going to start with that verse, and then we'll get into chapter 2. So the last verse of chapter 1 in our Bible says, "Look, there on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good news, who proclaims peace. Celebrate your festivals, Judah, and fulfill your vows. No more will the wicked invade you. They will be completely destroyed." So the prophet now turns like he's a spectator in Judah, and he turns like Nineveh has just been destroyed, and he's looking at the mountains outside of Jerusalem, and he sees messengers coming to deliver the good news. So the good news that Nineveh has fallen, the oppressor of Judah is now vanquished, and coming to proclaim peace, because there is no warrior to come against them for the time being. And so what he says is to Judah, celebrate your festivals, fulfill your vows. In other words, get back to life as normal. Celebrate Passover, celebrate the other things that are important in Jewish life. You know, get married, have children, do all the things that are part of life, and just celebrate being alive. Fulfill your vows, both to God and to each other. And he says, no more will the wicked invade you. They'll be completely destroyed. So we see here the prophet being excited about the fact that there is no longer a Nineveh. Now, if we said to Israel today, how good would it be if Hezbollah and Hamas were no longer there? You kind of get a sense for what this feels like for the prophet. But how big would it be to say Iran is no longer there? I mean, that's not going to happen. We know that from prophecy until later. But the reality is you can see in today's world how wonderful it would be for people to say, our oppressor is no more. We don't have to fear that any longer. So we come to chapter 2, and your verses may be a little different than mine. So this is the NIV, and what it says is an attacker. You can read that as disperser or scatterer in your Bible. It may be one of those three words, but it's talking about somebody to attack going to attack Nineveh. And he's saying here, let me get this out of the way so I can see it better. Advances is really going up on you. So remember in Jerusalem, we talk about going up to Jerusalem and going up in altitude, but also going up to God. So they're using that same kind of metaphor to say for Nineveh, the attacker is going up on you. Most of these cities were built on hills so they could defend themselves, and they had moats, and they had all kinds of other things that they had put up to, you know, slow down anywhere. And then what we see is a little change in tone. What you see here is this is a little bit of a rebuke, tongue-in-cheek rebuke from the prophet. He's telling Nineveh to get prepared, you know, guard the fortress as if they're not doing that. Watch the roads, brace yourself, marshal all your strength. I mean, this is what Nineveh is doing, but also the prophet knows that this is not going to be helpful because they're going to be defeated. So he's basically goading them, telling them to get ready, you know, it's coming. And then he says, and then, this is my comment at the bottom, Assyria gave no quarter in battle. They were fierce. As we talked about before, you know, they would cut people's heads off, they'd cut their limbs off, they'd skin them alive and put skin on the doors of the gates. They would flay them with knives, stake them out in the desert, and let the animals die from heat or die from animals and ants and everything else. They were wicked, and people did not want to be captured by them because of the pure evil. And you can sort of relate it to the ISIS when they were big and they were into the putting orange jumpsuits on and cutting off the heads of people and burning them alive and all the stuff they did to people, how horrible it was. Well, these are acolytes, if you will, of the Assyrians and of the Ninevites. That's the way they acted. People were scared to death of them. It brings to mind to me the verse in Galatians that says, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. And they've been sowing evil, and they're about to reap evil in their time. And we're going to get that laid out by the prophet. And kind of some clear tones. Now, you almost have to be a little bit of a history of the area to understand some of the meaning. I'll try to bring that out to you. But also, all of Hebrew writing, or a lot of Hebrew writing, is done in what's called parallel verses or counterpoint, where they'll say something and then they'll say something different. And it's kind of like a point-counterpoint. It's kind of a style of Hebrew writing. So we're seeing parallel verses here. So he's talking about destruction of Nineveh. Then he comes back to talk about the joy of Judah. He says, the Lord will restore the splendor of Jacob like the splendor of Israel, though destroyers have laid them waste and have ruined their vines. So he acknowledges the fact that God has brought judgment on Judah, but he's also giving them hope that the Lord will restore their splendor, you know, in the days ahead. And then he comes off to make a little bit of a point about what's happening in Nineveh. The Ninevites soldiers wore red, kind of scarlet red. You ever hear the phrase, she's seeing red right now, or he's seeing red? And it's sort of a phrase that means they're really up, they're angry. I don't know whether this is the origin of it, but it sounds pretty plausible to me. What these Ninevites would do is their shields were blood red, their tunics were red, much like Romans. And when an enemy saw the red coming on horseback and on chariot, it scared them to death because they knew it was the Ninevites. And so they are all dressed in red. It says the shields of the soldiers are red. The warriors are clad in scarlet. The metal on the chariot flashes. So most chariots in these days were made of wood. Now, they did have a little metal garnish on them here and there. But for these chariots, the ones made in Nineveh, and actually the ones in Babylon also, they had a lot of metal on them. And it may have been steel, it may have been iron, I don't know what it was, but it was a protection. And I'll give you a reason why they did that in a second. It says, the metal on the chariot flashes on the day they are made ready. So what that's telling us is that Nineveh has new chariots. They got the best chariots they have. They got metal on them. They flash in the sun. So when you see them coming, you not only see the red, but you see the metal glinting as the chariots come and the horses pull them. Kind of a scary time. And the spears of juniper are brandished. Sorry, they made spears out of, you know, long sticks, sharpened the points, put, you know, iron on the tip of them for spears. And in the chariots, they would use them for weapons. And all of this kind of sets the stage for what's going to happen when Nineveh begins to fall. So I'm going to look at the next verse. I want to talk about what's called a scythe chariot. I don't know whether any of you have ever heard that term before, but a scythe chariot is a chariot, and you can see a picture of one here, that has a scythe on the wheel. And when you would ride that chariot and you'd run up next to something, you would kill people and you'd destroy shields and everything like that. So this is the kind of chariots that are in this battle. They're called scythe chariots. And it says the chariots stormed through the streets, rushing back and forth through the squares. They look like flaming torches. They dart about like lightning. I want to show you something that will kind of give you an idea of what this looks like. And any of you ever, this will test our age and remembrance here. Any of you remember the movie Ben-Hur? Okay. Remember the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur? That was an Academy Award winning scene. I mean, you talk about special effects. And it's about 8 or 9 minutes long. I'm not going to play it all, but I've got some of it here, and I want to show you what it is like.